KBOO.FM/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So we often think of the land and the sea as separate worlds that have little to do with each other, but that barrier is much more fluid and interconnected than many people realize. We've talked on this program before about what folks call the land-sea connection, and today we're going to talk about the connection piece of that equation, estuaries. Estuaries are where the land and sea meet and intermingle and can be some of the most productive ecosystems in the world. So to talk all about the campaign to protect and restore Oregon's estuaries, I am so excited to be joined by Annie Merrill of Oregon Shores. Annie Merrill, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much. Happy to be here. Thank you for that lovely intro.
Well, thank you for joining me. Let's start off with just kind of the high-level overview. What is an estuary and why are they important ecosystems that folks should pay more attention to?
Yeah, of course. You said it so beautifully in the beginning. Estuaries are coastal bodies of water where rivers meet the ocean. And not only are they, you know, super important transition zones between land and sea, where brackish water mixes, but they're also very biologically productive areas that support a diversity of life, both marine and terrestrial. And, you know, they also offer a variety of important habitat types like tidal marshes, eelgrass meadows, mudflats, and sloughs. And, you know, these habitats are super important because, you know, they support many culturally important animals during different stages of their life, such as migratory birds and also commercially important fish and shellfish like salmon and Dungeness crab, you know, herring and rockfish. So estuaries are nurseries of the sea, essentially. They support many juvenile fish that spend their early lives in estuaries before heading out into the big ocean. So yeah, like you said, they're just really productive and important habitats.
That's a beautiful overview. Thank you for that. We should probably, you know, acknowledge that, like most of our landscapes, terrestrial and aquatic, estuaries have been really degraded over time, especially since, you know, white settlers came here. So could you talk just for a minute about how we got to this place where we need to be restoring them? What is the historical damage that has been done that we need to work to undo?
First of all, significant development tends to happen right on estuaries because they offer coastal protection. They're sort of sheltered from the outer coastline. And so they're perfect places for harbors and marinas that support water-dependent or maritime industries, as well as fisheries. And they also offer, you know, passage up river. And so it's no surprise that some of our biggest coastal cities were built right on estuaries. It was a very strategic move. You know, however, you know, as cities developed and grew in some places where, you know, there's limited land to develop, our estuaries have been severely altered and damaged from development. And this is particularly in the past 150 years. So not only did, you know, Euro-American settlers displace and kill indigenous people who were living and stewarding on our coast and living on these estuaries before, but when they built their cities, they restricted and altered tidal flow by building dikes and dams and levees to create room for farmland and essentially dry up wetlands so that they could build on top of them. Wetlands were also filled in, and the estuaries were dredged to create different channels. filled islands, and in some places, cities were built on dredged soils. And then additionally, you know, native oyster reefs were over harvested, and water quality has been compromised from, you know, other kind of land use changes in the watershed, such as logging or, you know, agricultural pollution. And then all of these things collectively have altered the hydrology of our estuaries and really dramatically changed habitats. So we've lost a lot of estuarine habitat, particularly wetlands. We're now losing our eelgrass meadows from climate stressors. So yeah, development has always had a bit of a toll on our estuarine ecosystem.
That kind of leads right into the need to be restoring and stewarding these estuaries in a better way, which is where the Campaign for Oregon's Estuaries comes in. So tell us a little bit about what Oregon Shores is doing and the goals of the Campaign for Oregon's Estuaries.
So our organization really recognizes the importance of estuaries, but also a gap in public action or knowledge about how important our estuaries are and support for our estuaries in comparison to our ocean and beaches, which, you know, everybody knows and appreciates. Mm-hmm. But we basically became very interested in estuary conservation during a long fight to stop the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas pipeline on the Coos Bay estuary. And through that legal battle, we learned that the Coos Bay Estuary Management Plan acted as a really essential regulatory protection against current and future development that could forever alter our estuaries. So in learning about this, how important these plans are, it became a priority for us to focus in on those plans. And then also we saw an opportunity because the Oregon Coastal Management Program is updating all of the state's estuary management plans, one or two at a time, many of which are 40 years old. And so we made it our mission to help strengthen these plans, to use this process to protect our essential estuaries and the species and habitats within them. And so our goal is to build public awareness and support for estuaries in the communities where these estuary management plans are being updated, so that we can collectively strengthen the plans in a way that benefits both people and the natural environment. And then, of course, we also recognize that engaging communities in estuary planning is really essential to creating a more inclusive and equitable future for our coast, particularly as many demographics were underrepresented and underserved when those plans were originally created. You know, their voices were left out.
Mm-hmm.
But also engaging communities in this process really fosters stewardship and care for estuaries, and that's our ultimate goal.
I love that this was, in some ways, like you say, an outgrowth of the battle against Jordan Cove. That's so beautiful to me that something on its own merits was such a great success story can then spawn like further success stories. So I love hearing that. I didn't realize that. Well, I know that you all have been working on two estuary management plans that we're going to kind of go back and forth in this program between saying estuary management plans and shorthanding it to EMPs. So I'd love to hear about the Yaquina Bay EMP process and the Coos Bay EMP process, and then maybe talk about what's on the horizon further. We're going to really, I think, spend a lot of time on the Coos Bay piece. So maybe we could start with the Yaquina, especially since that's my home river. So I'm, of course, interested in that.
Yeah, of course. Well, let's take it back a step and talk about, you know, what are estuary management plans? They're really important regulatory documents that basically determine who can do what where in each of our state's estuaries. They're basically land use and natural resource plans that guide state and local governmental review for proposed development and also restoration within an estuary. And then, you know, estuary management plans across the state are around 40 years old right now. So they were in bad need of updating. They also need to consider climate change and help build resilience mm-hmm. if they're going to be effective for the next several decades.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and they basically fall within our statewide land use planning program. So there are 18 goals within our planning program, and goal 16 refers to estuarine resources, and it basically guides through DLCD, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It basically guides how cities and counties should be managing the resources in their estuaries. So estuary management plans are basically included in comprehensive plans in cities and counties and their zoning codes, and it guides how local governments then manage those resources.
Man, I will just say as a side note, that sounds like a lot of different stakeholders to be balancing and interacting with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because there are so many uses of our estuaries. Mm-hmm. People look at estuaries and see water, but the way that they're managed are similar to land areas where they're zoned according to what resources are where. And so it's definitely a balancing act to determine what kind of uses are allowed in each area, but whether it's a dock or aquaculture or a port project or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump into then focusing on a couple of the specific EMPs. Let's start with the Yaquina Bay.
So the Yaquina Bay project was updated a year ago, completed last summer in 2023. They basically went through the whole update as a comprehensive update, and their goal was to also incorporate climate change into the plan. It is completed. It had an opportunity for public comment last summer, but it is now just kind of sitting there until the cities and the county decide to formally adopt it, which will be another full public process with a number of hearings before the planning commissions, city councils, the board of commissioners for each of those jurisdictions. It's yet to be adopted. We can maybe expect that in the next couple years. But what's happening, as far as my understanding goes, is that the county is trying to update estuary management plans for all of the other estuaries in the county, you know, including like Alzey Bay,
mm-hmm.
Before they adopt the Yaquina Bay plan so that they can do it all in one public process. Mm-hmm. And then the city of Newport might be moving ahead to adopt part of the plan into their zoning codes sooner than that. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, these different jurisdictions work together and navigate this public process.
Yeah. Wow. What could go wrong there? Okay. There are a lot of questions I could ask you about the wonky details of the public process and all that, but I am not going to do that. I just want to ask real quick before we move on to Coos Bay, what are some of the things that stand out to you about the Yaquina Bay process in terms of what is going to change if this EMP is adopted?
Yeah, I would say there are some really great strengths in the EMP. It's the first estuary management plan in Oregon to even mention climate change, which in my mind is a big win.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely outlines, you know, all of the climate stressors that you might anticipate if, you know, if you're a user of the plan, if you're somebody who wants to do a project, you basically have to go through a climate vulnerability assessment to see how your project might be impacted by, you know, specific climate hazards in a specific region of the estuary. So that's new. That's great. It also has updated maps that are digital maps. Before, they used to be hand-drawn Mylar maps, and it has updated data and, you know, new resource inventories that are more relevant to today.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it's more user-friendly. It has a better format. So all of those things are wins. We still think that there is more to do because this was certainly like a pilot project for everyone to kind of figure out, like, how do you incorporate climate change into an estuary management plan? And so, you know, there's more work to be done. I don't think this should be the end of this Yaquina Bay plan. So that's kind of something that we're hoping to achieve in this adoption process, is a commitment to keep working on this plan when there's more guidance from the state about how to do this better and how to more meaningfully incorporate climate change.
Mm-hmm. So where should folks go to get updated and keep abreast of that?
Yeah, so you can go to OregonShores.org, and if you go to Contact Us, there's a form there where you can submit that you have an interest in estuaries, and it'll direct any kind of inquiry directly to me. I send out county-specific bulletins with information about hearing dates and comment guides and things like that. I'll also be hosting webinars and workshops when it gets closer to public hearing dates, so that people know what the plan is about, they have tools to understand it and get involved.
Perfect. Okay, well, let's jump down south to Coos Bay. And this one is where it gets a little contentious, as I understand. Could you talk about the, before we get into that, though, just give us an overview of the Coos Bay Estuary Management Plan and the history of that so far. Bring us up to speed.
So the Coos Bay Estuary Management Plan is so large and complicated relative to many of the other estuary management plans in the state. And the first phase of the plan basically just included like changes to text that just brings the estuary management plan up to date with relevant and new changes to state departments and statutes and everything. And then they basically just updated maps. The second phase is expected to be a lot more comprehensive. We absolutely want to see climate change meaningfully incorporated into the plan. So the phase one just got adopted in January, and phase two we could expect to start in the next couple years, but it's definitely going to be a big lift, and I know that the county is seeking funding to make that happen. But the Coos Bay plan is so incredibly important right now because all sites are on Coos Bay to be the center of offshore wind development, and also the location of a new Pacific Coast intermodal port. That the International Port of Coos Bay is trying to build. So it's really important to get this plan updated and make sure that the community is very thoroughly involved and has the ability to create a vision for their estuary and what they want it to look like for the next 40 years.
Well, let's jump right into the thorny pieces there. I want to ask about offshore wind, but that is a little bit more in the future, to some degree. This Coos Bay container port project is something that is in the works if they can get funding right now. So tell us about the terminal project and where you all stand on that, what your concerns are.
Yeah, so essentially the International Port of Coos Bay and a company called North Point Development are aiming to build a multi-billion dollar shipping container terminal on the north bit of the bay. And so, you know, like think like those massive metal containers that you see on barges or in big ports like the Port of Seattle or Tacoma. So they're planning it on the north bit. But in order to build this, they would need to expand the depth and width of the federal navigation channel to allow for big container ships to get into the estuary and be able to turn around and, you know, head back out. And so that's a massive dredging project, which would have incredible impacts to the estuary's ecology, but also, you know, the functioning, the hydrology of the entire system. But one of the challenges that we've been facing is there's not very much information available to the public about the specifics of this project. So it's kind of challenging to accurately assess the impact, but we can certainly guess that expanding the size of the navigation channel, there's really important natural resources in the intertidal and subtidal that are adjacent to that navigation channel, such as clam and shellfish beds and eelgrass habitat that were zoned in the estuary management plan for conservation and protection because they're so important. And so if that channel is expanded, those resources would essentially be displaced, and there's no way to mitigate for that. But also, it means that there would be a larger volume of water that's able to enter the estuary. If you think about the channel being expanded, you know, doubled in size, that's more water that can make its way up the estuary. So it could alter like where specific habitats occur. It could alter water quality on such a large scale. And so it's such a big project, and we're just, you know, very wary about what it could do to the estuary. And especially if you think about the fact that some of these wetland habitats sequester an enormous amount of carbon. So dredging that, the estuary would release that carbon and also prevent those habitats from sequestering more carbon. So yeah, there's a lot of ecological challenges.
Yeah, but think of all the plastic they could bring in on those container ships. Think of people's knickknacks that they need, you know, commerce and all that. Well, actually, I do want to talk about, because, you know, these things always get framed as jobs versus the environment. And I know that you have, you know, an opinion on that. And so I just want to ask what your take is on kind of that framing, like, well, do you support jobs or do you support the environment?
Right. Yeah. It's such a false dichotomy for sure. So it's making the incorrect assumption first that destroying or harvesting a natural resource is necessary to create jobs and stimulate economic growth. And then also that the short-term economic benefits of doing so always outweigh the long-term economic, environmental, and social costs of that action, right? And so, mm-hmm. I mean, this can be applied to a lot of scenarios, but in general, our economy does not tend to reflect the true cost of environmental degradation. Let's say, you know, in forestry, we see this a lot. So trees only have economic value when they're cut down. But what about all of the other invaluable, unmeasurable benefits from ecosystem services that a forest provides, right? Like the clean air and water, support for biodiversity, temperature regulation, sediment stabilization. I could go on and on, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of those things have a real value to our communities. So the same is true for estuarine wetlands and in particular, like blue carbon habitat. They offer our best line of defense against climate change impacts and support resilient ecosystems. You know, they sequester and store enormous amounts of carbon. They protect coastal communities from coastal hazards. They buffer storm surges, reduce erosion. They filter and improve water quality, control floods. They buffer ocean acidification. So protecting our estuaries is a climate solution that offers incredible resilience benefits. Natural resource industries are also super important. There's a lot of like important research and restoration opportunities, tourism, fisheries and aquaculture that are collectively worth, you know, more money to the community than, a couple thousand, you know, jobs that might be created by a port project. And so it's just really important to think about, you know, the time scale. Is this a near-term benefit? Who is benefiting, right? Like are the jobs that are going to be created really going to benefit the community? Are they going to be long-term jobs? You know, when it comes to something like the port project, it's very likely that those jobs will be automated and there's going to be, you know, new technology and cranes that displace those jobs. But you also have to think about the conservation and restoration benefits that really greatly outweigh the private benefits of such a project. When you think about, you know, net economic and social losses spent trying to fix environmental problems that we frequently create. So, you know, it could be hatcheries, like spending a bunch of money on hatcheries to supplement fisheries or restore salmon populations. Like the state spends billions on that. Mm-hmm. We also spend a lot of money on flood and coastal hazard mitigation and damage to infrastructure. You know, there's a lot of money spent combating, you know, air pollution and invasive species and poor water quality. And recovering from natural disasters. So it's just so important to like look at the big picture and how these ecosystems support the communities more holistically. It's way too simplified and I don't know, it's false. It's really leaving out a big part of the picture to just pit the situation as, you know, this one little environmental area, just some of these seagrasses that we can, you know, just plant elsewhere versus jobs and the economy. It's just way too simplified.
Right. There's a lot we could unpack there about externalization and all that, but I agree that it is this false dichotomy. And I think that the point you raise about if we accurately were valuing all of the inputs and outputs of these projects, the calculus would be a lot different.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you know, what about the social cost of not only emitting more carbon at this stage of the climate crisis, but destroying a habitat that would otherwise be sequestering lots of carbon? Like these habitats are increasingly seen as a very essential climate solution. And because we're losing much of our wetlands and eelgrass habitats, and they're becoming more and more rare, right? Like their value is even higher than ever before.
but not to the people financing these container ship projects, right? It's not going in their pockets, so.
Absolutely. Who's benefiting here?
Yeah. You know, and none of that is to make light of the situation of struggling towns like Coos Bay. That is a really tricky and complicated issue. That is why these large corporations always pick places like Coos Bay to come into, or you look up north in Longview, Washington, these somewhat economically depressed, typically historically blue-collar places. It's easy prey to sort of promise people the moon and the sky. You're going to bring all the manufacturing jobs back, et cetera. It's a lot more complicated than that and more than we have the time to really get into today. But I appreciate your take on that. So we are actually getting short on time. There's a lot more that I wanted to cover. But to make sure that we have time for it, could you tell us one more time how folks can get involved and learn more about the process for the campaign for Oregon's estuaries, about Oregon Shores, and get in touch?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best way is to go to our website at OregonShores.org and to sign up for our newsletter. We send out a monthly newsletter with updates about all of our different campaigns and projects. There's also a contact me form on our website where, you know, you can express interest in estuaries, you can give us your zip code so I send out, you know, pretty frequent, you know, county specific bulletins about projects that directly affect specific communities. And then, yeah, you can contact me directly on that form as well. And then in all likelihood, you know, your community and your estuaries are next in line. So it's very likely that, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, you know, we're going to see all of the estuaries in Tillamook County go through estuary management plan updates. And so we're certainly going to be involved in that process. And then same with Clatsop County and, you know, the Lower Columbia River. So there's going to be lots of opportunities in the future for public engagement. There's also a really great process being led by the Oregon Coastal Management Program to create estuary resilience action plans, which aren't regulatory documents, but they're basically like climate hazard assessments that come with, you know, natural climate solutions identified for each county, each estuary, each community. That provides information to any kind of organization, local government, or individual who might want to undertake some kind of restoration project or figure out how to build more resilience in their communities. And so you can get involved in that planning process in Lincoln County right now. There's going to be a community listening session coming up here in March, actually, in a couple weeks. I think the first one is on the 27th of March. And there's plenty of things that folks can do to volunteer and get involved in estuary restoration.
And we'll make sure to include links to all of these things that you're talking about and how to get in touch with you, how to get involved in those listening sessions in the show notes of the podcast feed, also at our website, coastrange.org. But obviously your website is just OregonShores.org, and that's a wealth of information about all that you do and an easy way to get in touch. Well, we are running out of time here. I really enjoyed talking with you, Annie, and I really appreciate the work that you and Oregon Shores is doing to protect and conserve and restore our estuaries. So before we wrap up, is there anything we missed? Anything you want to make sure gets included?
Thank you so much for your time. I would just say you can learn more about us and support our work, donate, volunteer, sign up for our newsletter, all that good stuff at OregonShores.org.
Well, great. Annie Merrill, thank you so much for joining me on Coast Range Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a joy talking to you.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. You can find links and resources to everything we discussed today in the episode description of the podcast or at our website, coastrange.org. We would love it if you would leave the show a rating and review on whatever podcast app you use. If you want to get in touch, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks.
listener-supported community radio, KBOO.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors. In preparation for our annual board election in September, KBOO's nominating committee